It was the first time he'd spoken in hours, and Sean was encouraged. He had begun seriously worrying about his client. Now he responded quickly. "This was once a paradise of big game. I hunted here before the Portuguese pulled out, and the buffalo were running in herds, 10,000 strong. What happened to them? Frelimo fed the army with them. They even offered me the contract for the slaughter. They couldn't understand why I refused. In the end, they did it themselves."
"How did they do it?"
"From helicopters. They flew low over the herds, machine-gunned them. They killed almost 50,000 buffalo in 3 months. For all that time, the sky was black with vultures, and you could smell the killing fields from 20 miles off. When the buffalo were finished, they started on the other game, the wildebeest and the zebra."
"What a cruel and savage land this is," Claudia said quietly.
"Surely you don't disapprove?" Sean asked. "It was done by black men, not whites. It couldn't possibly be wrong." He glanced at his Rolex wristwatch. "Time to move on." He put out his hand to help Ricardo to his feet, but the older man shrugged the hand away. Nevertheless, Sean fell in beside him as the march resumed and let Claudia move up directly behind Matatu while he chatted quietly to her father, jollying him along, trying to distract him from his weariness. He recounted anecdotes from the Bush War. He pointed out the site of the guerrilla training camp as they passed a few miles north of it, and described the raid by the Ballantine scouts. Ricardo was interested enough to ask questions.
"This Comrade China sounds like a good field commander," he commented. "Did you ever find out what happened to him after he escaped?"
"He was active right up to the end of the war. A tough cookie, all right. His men had to backpack all their munitions into Rhodesia, and a Russian T-5 anti-tank landmine weighs almost 70 pounds. The story goes that Comrade China brought in one of them at an enormous cost in sweat and blood and laid it on the main Mount Darwin road for one of our regular armoured patrols. However, the local blacks had hired a bus that same weekend to go into town to watch the football match, and they touched off the landmine. There were 65 of them on the bus, and 23 of them survived the explosion. Comrade China was so incensed by the waste of his precious T-5 that he sent for all the next of kin of the victims and the survivors who were still able to walk and fined them each $10 to cover the cost of another landmine." Ricardo had to stop and double over with laughter, and Claudia turned on them furiously.
"How can you laugh? This is the most outrageous story I have ever heard."
"Oh, I don't know," Sean replied evenly. "I don't think $10 was so outrageous. I think old China was being fairly lenient." She tossed her head and lengthened her stride to catch up with Matatu. And Ricardo asked, still chuckling, "After the war, what happened to this character?" Sean shrugged. "He was in the new government in Harare for a while, but then he disappeared in one of the political purges. He might have been liquidated. The old revolutionaries are always looked on with distrust when the regime they fought for comes to power. Nobody likes sharing a bed with a trained killer and toppler of other rulers." Sean called a halt an hour before dark for a brew of tea and their frugal evening meal. While Job cooked it over his small, smokeless fire, Sean took Matatu aside and talked to him quietly. The tracker watched Sean's face as he spoke, nodding eagerly, and as soon as he finished, Matatu slipped away, heading back the way they'd come. Ricardo asked a question as Sean came back to join them, and he explained.
"I sent Matatu to backtrack us, make sure we aren't being followed. I'm worried about that shot. It could have called up those uglies we found near the border."
Ricardo nodded, and then asked, "Have you got a couple of aspirin, Sean?" Sean opened the side flap of his pack and took 3 anodyne tablets from their bottle. "Headache?" he asked as he passed them to Ricardo, and he nodded as he popped them into his mouth and washed them down with a swallow of hot tea. "The dust and sun and glare," he explained. But both Sean and Claudia were studying him, and Ricardo bridled.
"Damn it, don't look at me like that. I'm fine."
"Sure," Sean agreed smoothly. "Let's eat and move on to find a place to sleep." He went across to the cooking fire and squatted beside Job. They talked quietly.
Papa?
Claudia moved a little closer to her father and touched his arm.
How are you feeling? Honestly?
Don't worry about me, DeSoro.
It started, hasn't it?
No,
he replied too swiftly.
Doc Andrews said there might be headaches.
It's the sun.
I love you, Papa, she said.
I know, baby. And I love you, too.
An ocean and a mountain? She asked.
The stars and the moon, he confirmed, and put his arm round her shoulders. She leaned against him.
As soon as they had eaten, Job doused the fire, and Sean got them up and moving again. Tukutila's spoor was easy to follow in the soft earth, and he and Job had no need of Matatu for this stage. However, at dark, they were forced to stop for the night.
"We'll reach the swamps tomorrow afternoon," Sean promised Ricardo as they stretched out on top of their sleeping bags.
Claudia lay awake, worrying about her father, long after the others were asleep. Ricardo snored softly, lying on his back with arms extended like a crucifix. When she raised herself on one elbow to look at him in the starlight, she heard Sean's light breathing alter subtly and sensed that he was awakened by her movement. He slept as lightly as a cat. Sometimes he frightened her. Even her concern for her father was at last overcome, and she fell into that dark, drugged sleep of exhaustion. Waking was like coming back from a faraway place.
"Wake up! Come on, wake up!"
Sean was slapping her face lightly, and she pushed his hand away and sat up, groggily.
"What?" she mumbled. "God, it's still dark."
He had left her and gone to her father.
"Come on, Capo, wake up, man, wake up."
"What the hell? What is it?"
Ricardo's voice was slurred and grumpy. "Matatu's just come back into camp," Sean told them quietly. "We are being followed." Claudia felt the icy wind of dread blow across her skin.
"Followed?
By whom?"
"We don't know," Sean said.
"The same bunch that were camped at the border?" Ricardo asked.
His voice was still slurred.
"Possibly," Sean said.
"What are you going to do?"
Claudia asked, and was annoyed that her tone sounded afraid and confused.
"We are going to give them the slip," Sean said. "Get up on your hind legs."
They had slept with their boots on. They had simply to roll their sleeping bags, and they were ready to move out.
"Matatu is going to lead you away and cover your spoor," Sean explained. "Job and I are going to lay a false trail for them in the original direction. As soon as it's light, we'll break away and circle back to join you."
You aren't going to leave us alone?" Claudia blurted fearfully,
and then bit it off. "No, you won't be alone. Matatu and Pamula and Dedan will be with you," Sean told her disdainfully. "What about the elephant?" Ricardo demanded. His voice had firmed. "Are you breaking off the hunt? You gonna let my elephant get away? For a few lousy gooks and with a couple of lousy AK-47s? Sean chuckled. "Don't be ridiculous, Capo. We will shake them off and be after Tukutila again before you know it."
Sean and Job waited while Matatu assembled his group and then shepherded them away. By now, Ricardo and Claudia had learned the basics of anti-tracking and went swiftly under Matatu's direction, while the tracker brushed and covered the sign behind them. Once they were clear, Sean and Job trampled the area around the camp, back and forth and round in circles, until they had confused any remaining spoor, and then they fell into single file, Sean leading, and went away at a run. They didn't make it too apparent that they were laying a false trail, but adopted all the usual precautions, which would not fool a good tracker. It was the old scout's pursuit pace that Sean set, 7 miles an hour, and gradually he began to veer off in a southerly direction. Matatu was heading northwards towards the river, and Sean would lead the pursuit directly away from them. While he ran, Sean puzzled over the identity of his pursuers. Government soldiers or rebels? Poachers? Or simply armed bandits looking for plunder? It was impossible to guess.
However, Matatu had been worried when he came into camp.
"They are good, Bwana," he told Sean. "They've done well to follow the spoor we left. And they're coming on fast. They move in formation like bushfighters, with flankers out."
"Didn't you get a good look?" Sean had asked. And the little Ndrobo shook his head.
"It was getting dark, and I wanted to get back to warn you. They were closing in swiftly."
"Even the best tracker won't be able to follow us in darkness. We've got the rest of the night to get clear of them."
It was a strange reversal of roles, Sean thought grimly, as he and Job trotted through the dark bush. They, the hunters, were now being hunted just as remorselessly. At first he'd considered breaking off the chase after the elephant and doubling back for the border. Ricardo Montero's condition was causing him real concern, and so was Matatu's warning that their pursuers were skilled and appeared dangerous. However, he had swiftly rejected the idea. They were beyond the point of no return.
"No turning back," Sean said aloud, and grinned as he admitted to himself the true reasons for his determination. 2 ivory tusks and $500,000 in cash. By now he was honestly not certain which of those was the most compelling. Those tusks were beginning to loom large in his imagination. They represented the old Africa, a symbol of a better world that had vanished. He wanted them more than he'd ever wanted anything in his life, except perhaps $500,000. And he grinned again. In the first light of dawn, they were running directly southwards, and they had covered 20 miles since splitting off from the rest of the party.
"Time to disappear, Job," he grunted, without breaking a stride. There must be no indication to the trackers following them that they were about to split again.
"Good place just ahead," Job agreed. He was running exactly in Sean's footprints.
"Do it," Sean said. And as they ran under the low branches of a grevia tree, Job reached up and swung himself off the ground. Sean did not look back, did not alter his stride. Job would work himself through the branches of the closely growing grevia until he found a good place to drop off and anti-track away. Sean ran on for 20 minutes, once again curving away into the southwest, heading for a low ridge that just showed in the dawn ahead of him. He crossed the ridge, and as he had anticipated from the lie of the terrain, found a small river in the valley beyond. He drank at the edge of the pool and milled around, splashing water onto the bank as though he were bathing. A tracker would expect him to choose this as a breakaway point, wading either upstream or downstream before leaving the river again. They would send scouts along both banks to search for sign. Sean waded downstream, supporting himself on overhanging branches to give them a trail to confirm their suspicions. Then, without leaving the water, he returned to the exact spot where he had entered the stream, and on the bank he carefully dried his feet and legs, replaced his dry felskoon shoes that he had hung around his neck on their laces, and backtracked on his incoming spoor. He retraced his footsteps to the crest of the ridge, walking backwards, stepping precisely on his original footprints, and at the top of the ridge he employed the same trick that Job had. He swung himself into the air from a branch and overhanded himself well clear of the spoor before lowering himself to the edge of a rock slab and anti-tracking away.
"Even Matatu wouldn't be able to unravel that," he thought with satisfaction, as he struck off back towards the north at a run.
2 hours later, he joined up with Job at the rendezvous, and in the early afternoon they came up with the other party, waiting for them 5 miles north of the point where they had split up.
"Good to see you, Sean. We were beginning to worry," Ricardo told him as they shook hands, and even Claudia smiled as he flopped down beside her and said, "My kingdom for a cup of tea."
As he sipped at the mug which Matatu brought him, he listened attentively to the little tracker. Matatu squatted beside Sean and chattered in his usual excited falsetto.
"Matatu went back and kept an eye on the camp we left," Sean translated for Ricardo and Claudia's benefit. "He didn't dare approach too closely, but he saw the gang that was following us arrive. This time, he counted 12 of them.